Leading Ideas Talks podcast is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly e-newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas. Leading Ideas Talks podcast is also brought to you by the premier Doctor of Ministry in Church Leadership Excellence from Wesley Seminary and the Lewis Center. Learn more and register now for May 2022 at churchleadership.com/DMIN. What determines whether children will carry on the faith of their parents? Past research established that parents play the critical role. In this episode, noted sociologist Christian Smith shares new research examining how parents shape their children's faith and the critical factor of talking about religion in the context of day-to-day life.
I'm Ann Michael. I'm one of the editors of Leading Ideas e-newsletter, and I'm host for this episode of Leading Ideas Talks. I am so thrilled to have the opportunity today to speak with a renowned researcher and sociologist, Christian Smith. He serves as the William R. Kennan Professor of Sociology at Notre Dame University, and his extensive body of work has addressed many concerns of interest to church leaders, ranging from race and religion and evangelicalism to giving and generosity and the spiritual lives of young adults and youth. So his most recent work with co-author Amy Adamczyk, who's professor of sociology at John Jay College in New York, the book is Handing Down the Faith, How Parents Pass Their Religion to the Next Generation. And that's the subject we'll be focusing on today. So welcome, Dr. Smith.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So this book builds on the findings of previous religion by your previous research by yourself and others that demonstrates that the role of parents is the most critical factor in determining whether their children will continue to practice the faith when grown. And so just to bring our listeners up to that starting line, if you will, could you explain that backdrop?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of years studying the religious lives of teenagers and then 20-year-olds and sort of what affected them. And there's a broader cultural narrative that suggests that after kids turn, 12 or 13, that parents don't matter anymore. Other factors take over, like the media or peers, school, whatever. But what we found, and it shouldn't be surprising, although it was surprising initially, is that when it comes to the sort of the longer term formation of young people, their parents are actually the much more important than any other factor. And then clergy, youth group, mission trip, pretty much anything. Parents have this decisive, normally, as a generalization, have this sort of really important formative power, really, over how their kids turn out. Teenagers don't realize that usually, and a lot of parents don't realize right. that, but that's sociologically what goes on. And of course, this is not determinative. Parents can't control their kids. Children in different families turn out differently. But as a broad generalization, the lives and the practices and the intentions and the influence of parents is really powerful. And so we followed up that research with a project studying parents themselves and how religious parents try to approach and shape their kids religiously.
Right. So your purpose in this book, your and Dr. Adamczyk's purpose is to really answer the how question. I mean, how does this transmission of religion from parents to children happen? And so can you describe how you went about that inquiry?
Yeah. It's not a how-to book, but it's a how parents approach right. it, how they try to do it. So we interviewed 235 religious parents in the United States from different traditions, Christian and non-Christian, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Latino Catholic, white Catholic, Mormon, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, etc., a whole variety of different kinds of parents looking for differences. So we had these in-depth two and a half hour interviews with parents, sometimes the same parent from different households. We tried to get parents of different socioeconomic backgrounds, different family structures, single parents and so on, race and ethnic differences, black Protestant parents. And it was really an exploration of, from parents' perspective, what do they assume? What's their experience? How do they approach it? What's their strategy? How do they feel? What's it like? Really to try to understand that angle, because we really hadn't, there's really not a lot of research out on how parents are approaching this task, given how important they are in the process.
Yeah, and so just to clarify for our listeners, these weren't just any parents. These were religious parents in the sense
we sampled our parents through religious congregations. So this is not nationally representative. It's people that have some attachment to a religious congregation. However, we sampled about half of them who are quite involved in their religious congregations. And then the other half, we intentionally sampled those who are less involved. We didn't want to just get this like the superstars of a church. We wanted to also hear from those who have a little more distance or marginal involvement to see if there was much of a difference there.
You know, I think one of the interesting findings for me in this research was the fact that even though you looked at a very broad array of different religious traditions, the findings were the same, largely, whether you were looking at somebody who was a Hindu or a Mormon, Do you want to speak to that a bit?
Sociologists are used to making comparisons between groups. And so we had our antennae up to like tune into how are different kinds of parents different that we sampled for that. And what we actually came across was the vast majority of religious parents in America, even not Christian, all different traditions and backgrounds, take a very similar approach to their understanding about what is the value of religion, why it would be good for your kids to be religious, how to go about it, what are some of the challenges and problems. So, yeah, we were really struck by the profound similarities in what we call the cultural models that are operating in parents' minds in the background, informing how they go about this challenge.
Mm-hmm. So I think the real banner headline for me, at least, in reading this book is that it seems that the most instrumental factor is when parents talk about faith with their children, but not just, you know, when they're in the car coming and going from Sunday school or when they're saying bedtime prayers, but when there's kind of an ongoing narrative just in the course of everyday life, when parents are addressing matters of faith, sort of in that context, kind of normalizing the conversation about faith as part of daily life. So I want to ask, have I gotten this right? And if so, can you say more about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we all might expect, it wouldn't be surprising that parents who attend religious services more often, or for whom personally faith is more important, their kids would turn out to be more religious, right? That makes total sense. But even more important as a variable in our analyses than those two is the factor, do parents talk with their children during the week about religious things? So if you start to think about it, you can imagine households where they go to church, that's it. The rest of life, they don't talk about faith. They don't talk about anything like that. It's just a, like a little compartmentalized part of life, versus you can consider families where in and through ordinary life and conversations, family talks about, you know, well, what does Christianity have to say about this? Or what would the church teach? Or they could talk about all sorts of different aspects of this. But just the fact that conversations that bring religion in during the week about presumably ordinary parts of life, could be anything, sports, the news, something going on in the family. It turns out to be such a powerful correlation with children in those families turning out to be more religious as they grow up. We didn't expect that when we went into it, but it's just over and over in any analysis, that's a really powerful factor. And so it's worth really thinking about both in terms of sociology, how and why does that work? But also practically, if parents want to influence their kids to be religious, sort of how to do that. Now, we're not talking about preaching to kids or having a set hour where the parent is going to read the catechism or something. It appears that needs to be a much more natural process that just reflects, what do the parents care about? What are they thinking about? What is the family kind of process? So, I just think that's a really interesting finding and something worth pondering.
Yeah, sure. And it seems like it's really actionable, too, in the sense that for parents and church leaders who care about this, I mean, that seems like it's a really important takeaway.
Yeah. And I mean, part of what comes out of our study is that in a way, it puts a lot of responsibility on parents. The way society has evolved, most of the responsibility for how kids are going to turn out religiously actually falls on the shoulders of parents, for better or worse, you know, not clergy, not youth ministers. And so that may put a lot of responsibility on, and it may terrify some parents, but I think it's important to keep it in perspective. It's not rocket science. You don't need a Master of Divinity degree to influence your. A lot of it is just being an authentic person of faith where it's important in your life, and talking about that, being open about that, sharing. Kids are smart. They're perceptive. For the most part, they can see what's going on. Parents can't suddenly put on a pious hat and act something that they're not. So it's really just a matter of making this important in life and communicating and living that, and kids pick up on it and it influences them. So really, in the end, we get what we are, not what we hope to be or pretend to be.
So one part related to this issue of conversation that just really, really struck me, there's a part of the book where you and Dr. Adam Schick write that religious language is not mainstream America's first language. It's at best a second language. And if children only hear that language an hour or two or a week, they never become fluent enough to feel comfortable speaking that language as adults. Man, that rang so true to me. I really grew up in a nominally religious household. It wasn't until I was an adult that I really started to explore and really struggle with the meaning of faith. And I was very aware of the fact that I was learning a new language. And that really helped me make sense of why this ongoing conversation becomes so important.
Yeah. So a lot of us have had experiences learning languages, and there's two different ways to think about it. One is you have a 45-minute class one day a week, and you go in and you work on it in your Spanish class or whatever. It's not very effective. We know that the best way to learn a language is to be immersed in it, to go to the country, to be forced to learn it, to have it surround, and it sort of takes over one's thinking. That we really learn language, second languages, that way, very much better. So if you use that analogy for this, like, again, as you just explained, the dominant language of our culture is individualism, is competition, is consumerism. It's not Christian gospel, let's say. So if children are going to learn to have a vocabulary, to be able to express and name parts of their life that have to do with their faith, it matters. Just like at learning Spanish, like, people need practice. People need to learn words. People need a chance not just to read it in a textbook, but to talk in ordinary language with people around them who also talk that way, and to pick up that kind of second language. And when we studied teenagers, a lot of them, we asked them questions about what they believe and so on. A lot of them said, I don't know, nobody's ever asked me that question before. Yeah. So I think part of what's going on is a lack of context in which people can learn to speak and also therefore to think and express the spiritual or religious part of their life. Just need some chance for practice at it. And so that goes back to the earlier point, when children have a chance to do that at home with their parents and family context, that's a totally different way of learning about religious faith and how to think and express it than just listening to church an hour a week, you know.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for that analogy, because that really helped, I think, drive home for me why this ongoing conversation is so important. Another thing that really stood out to me, throughout the book was why parents were motivated to want to talk with their children about faith and have their children carry on the faith. And largely your research reveals that it's not because of the parents' own deeply held religious beliefs, but because parents think that religion is going to help their children be better people, or help provide moral guidance, or provide comfort and support, or family unity. And as a person of faith, that really struck me as, you know, that these motives were largely instrumental and not theological. I just wanted to sort of introduce that subject and see what you had to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, we really liked and were very impressed by the parents we talked with. We don't want to come off critical of them. And there's a lot of really good, impressive religious parents out there in the world who are really trying their best. But one thing that came out of this is a lot of them are not motivated because they want their child to go to heaven, or they're concerned about salvation, or they want to honor God, or it's social justice, God's justice and peace in the world, or these sort of larger transcendent or afterlife issues. Most parents said the reason why it's good to have religious faith and why I want my children to is life is a journey. Life is hard. Religious faith and practice are like a home base that my child can return to. They provide resources. So very this worldly, you said instrumental, but very this worldly sort of motivations and interests or values of why religion matters helps people make good choices. It helps them from doing stupid things. It provides them a guidance, essentially. The master frame is life is a journey. The journey is hard. Religion provides guidance, like a map, a roadmap, kind of a shelter when things get going really bad. And so we came away from that thinking, you know, what a lot of people in churches probably think they're providing their members seems to be different, or there's like a mismatch between that and what the people who are coming to church are there for. So, and I wonder if that just helps to explain, you know, some of the misunderstandings or different differences of views of what we're doing here, or what the church should be doing. So we really wanted to bring that out too, as a chance for people to consider, like, what is this all about? Why are people motivated?
So since our listeners are church leaders, you do have portions of the book that address the role of the faith community in relation to this primary role that parents play in fostering the faith of their children. So what's the main takeaway of the research with regard to the role of faith communities?
Most parents view their congregations as secondary, as in supportive roles, as providing some resources. They understand themselves as being the primary socializer. I know from talking to lots of people in church and ministry that that's not their view. They think parents, you know, drop off the kids and want the church to do it all, but that's not what we heard from parents. So there's another disconnect there that I think is worth figuring out. But what the parents said is, again, they don't have super high expectations of their religious congregations. They want a place that's friendly, where their children will have some friends. There'll be some enjoyable programming. There'll be some sense of community, but not there wasn't a lot of religious or spiritual or theological or liturgical demands placed on churches for what they were offered. It was more just sort of a background reinforcing factor, not primary role factor. And again, just the sense of an enjoyable community that they hope their kids will be okay wanting to go to for a while. The other thing I put out there, I have another chapter in there. It's an interpretive chapter, but I talk about how I think the larger culture has changed and the role of religion in it, so that the model I use is in the old days, so to speak, not to view history through rose-colored glasses, but in the old days, religion was more of what I call communities. Solidarity reality. It brought communities together. It held people together. It gave people an identity. There was a community basis for religious formation. And now I think that's transformed into sort of an individual a life accoutrement or accessory, a personal life accessory. So people may plug into a congregation or think of themselves as religious in the same way they are in a swim club or the YMCA or wear earrings, or that it's a plug in and out thing, and it's much more individualistic. And that changes the character of what a church is and what people are expecting from it.
Yeah, I certainly for me, one of the most interesting one of the most interesting messages of the book was this sort of meta narrative about societal changes that were impacting both the nature of family life and parenting, as well as the role of church in society. And so things are different than when I grew up in the 50s and the 60s in terms of how we understood religion functioning in our life and how we were going to connect to the institution of the church, if I'm rephrasing that correctly.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I think that's exactly what's been going on. And I think most people who are tuned in have a sense, yeah, things really have changed. But it's a matter of kind of really drilling down and figuring out what are the changes, what have caused them, and what are the consequences. That in this book, we try to spell some of that out. And I'm continuing in some research along those lines. Also, demographic changes. So historically, the American family, the nuclear family, has been a crucial piece of doing church, of churching. And we all know that's been changing with the divorce revolution, a rise of more and more cohabitation, delayed marriage, not getting married, not having children. All of these demographic changes have consequences for whether or not people in their 20s and 30s are going to return to church. Right. That really need to be understood. It's not a matter of what the church is offering. It's a matter of what's happening around churches and society that changes the situation.
Yeah, I think, to me, there was a hopeful message in the book in terms of how invested and instrumental parents are in informing their children. But there was also a pretty disturbing message, I think, about how, you know, the institutional church has so much less of a role than we imagine. In all kinds of things, but especially in how children are coming to faith. So you make it clear in the book that your role as a researcher is to provide information and not make recommendations. But I think that this research really does call into question some of the standard approaches to the formation of children and youth that are normative in churches today. And so, I'm going to ask you, if you, Christian Smith, were speaking to your own pastor or the Christian Education Committee in your own church, what would you most want them to know and do based on what you found in this book?
I mean, I think part of it is, again, you're right. I'm not a ministry consultant, but the implications of our findings are pretty straightforward and clear. The first thing is the very first point you raised, which is parents should really know and not sort of evade responsibility. It's really on their shoulders and how their kids turn out. They can't control them, but they have a significant degree of influence over that. And so parents really need to give this thought and think, what are not what's urgent, but what's important? What do I really value and want to see over the long run here, and to invest in that? Another word we think of as being intentional. This isn't just going to happen by accident. Parents really need to be intentional and proactive about things. Again, that's not controlling. It's not over manipulative or anything like that, but being intentional. So
churches might just help parents understand the importance of their role and claim it.
Yeah, churches can help parents understand. They can provide context for parents to think and talk those things out. Some parents are really still working through how they were raised as children religiously. And so, you know, they need to work through things. And so provide a context to sort those things out so they don't get in the way. And then figure out how they can be helpful and supportive of parents during the week and not just provide nice programs. Another way to think about all this is, what really, really matters in all this is relationships, not programs. Programs that support relationships and build relationships are good. There's nothing wrong with program, but programs themselves aren't going to really change anybody. It's relationships. And so churches may need to step back and rethink, you know, how do we connect with families during the week? Instead of thinking, gosh, we're competing against sports and we're competing against schools. Maybe there are ways for the church to not be competing, but be out there with the parents on the sidelines or you know, talking about how your kid is... more integrated out in the worlds of people instead of just asking people to come to church buildings for services and programs. So I don't have this all worked out, but I think there needs to be a lot of creative rethinking.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the example you just gave, because that's not something that came to my mind in reading the book. And that does seem to be a clear possibility of, you know, getting not instead. I mean, so much of our thinking in church now is, you know, not how do we get people to come to church, but how do we go to where life is? And if faith formation is happening out there every day, that is a good, I think, clue for churches and how they can relate to the lives of children and their parents. So I want to begin to draw this to a close. But I wanted to ask you a final question, which is, you know, you are clearly a ceaseless researcher. and so you're researching without, you know, without end. What, based on this work, what questions are still in your mind, and what more do you want to know? What's the next field of inquiry that you are pointed to based on these findings?
Yeah, good question. I'm actually turning my attention now to the more sort of macro social and cultural transformations over the last decades that put this into more context. So rather than studying the religious lives of teenagers or how parents try to pass on faith, I have a project where I'm starting to explore, because we know that it's starting in the 90s, there's this growth of non-religious Americans, and young people especially are very much less interested in religion than older generations. So there are generational dynamics. So I'm trying to explore now what happened in the 1990s and the 2000s. I think those are the two crucial decades. Not in churches, but outside, like with technology, with the internet, with the end of the Cold War, with all sorts of other dynamics, neoliberalism coming in the 80s that changed the environment, almost created a different zeitgeist that's hard to put our fingers on, but really changed what religion is in the larger picture. And therefore, how and why millennials and Gen Xers and now Gen Z young people sort of hear or don't hear or respond or don't respond to broadly religious concerns, but also specifically sort of Christian gospel, the Christian narrative. So that's what I'm focused on. Like, what is the larger environmental context, and how do we explain this sort of new? I'm actually thinking, I kind of call it the spiritual secular zeitgeist. It's not totally secular, and it's not totally spiritual. It's not religious. It's not institutional religion. There's a strong, quote unquote, spiritual dimension, but it's not spiritual in the way historically the church would have thought about that. So it's just a weird mixture. So I'm trying to figure out what brought that into being, and what does it mean?
Yeah, well, that'll be really, really fascinating. I look forward to reading that, because I think that'll help us put a lot of pieces into place as we're trying to figure out exactly what the religious landscape is.
The landscape, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you traverse a terrain when you don't even have a map of the landscape?
Yeah. Well, we certainly look forward to that. Dr. Smith, I want to thank you for talking with us today. I want to thank you for this incredibly eye-opening book, but also for your whole body of work. I mean, I have learned so much from others of your books as well. I work in stewardship ministry, and Passing the Plate and The Paradox of Generosity are like gospel to me. They have helped me form my own ideas and refine my theology and my teaching. I assign the books to students. I love them. So you have helped me so much, and I just want to thank you for your tremendous body of work.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure. I enjoy doing what I do, and I'm glad to hear it's helpful to others. So
yeah. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.